Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Nau mai, haere mai. I'm John McDonald, kia ora, and welcome into the Community Drive Hut Zone on Thursday, the 19th of February. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the stories, people, history, poems, and music that make the Hutt Valley community. I hope you all safely got through the storm earlier this week. Losing power, trees down, flooding, and debris everywhere has been pretty tough for us all. Let's relax a bit, spend the next hour together here in the Hut Zone. Tonight we meet visiting comedian Brendan Green, who's running a confidence and public speaking workshop in Petone on Sunday the 1st of March. It's aimed at teenagers, boosting confidence, and it's free. We finish our series with former librarian Alan Smith, looking back and forward into the role libraries play in our communities. We have music from Vox Ethno and William Berry. Let's start the show off with poetry from Eastern Bay's Mary McCallan.
Southern Man, a Sestina. The mouth of the harbour and the mountains are bleached table linen, starched peaks. I run to keep our meeting at Hekatara Street, to walk to the harbour mouth, bright with that fallen linen, to hold our hands out to the steep land across from us, the strait between, your land, the south. Walk with me, speak of your blue house built on the hillside here, speak of the sheets he hung out each Saturday, sun-bleached and flapping, of the cabbage trees clapping in the southerly the day Rose was born. George, who keeps building with driftwood on the beach, teepees with steep angles that stand the storms, Elsie with her cook's mouth, chasing the combination of sweet and sour so the mouth pinches and smiles all at once. Old Molly's lagging. You speak to her gently, tie her lead to the tree, and turning, find a steeple, George's careful construction, the wood clean, bleached by the sea, a place of safety, a place to keep watch. He knows to make it strong, face it south, like the house on the hillside with the south-facing beech trees crowding the windows, the yellow-mouthed gorse, the two fat kereru, part treehouse, part keep. Its casement windows built to speak to the linen mountains, to the pressing sky, to the bleached confounding light. And how to describe the steep of your grief after 4 years away, to find steeper than mountains, sky blue roofing blocking the south. Behind the faded curtains and the bleached window frames, all you left to return to, lost. The mouth of your grief is sour. You speak of vertigo, pale children, peaks in sight only up at the clothesline. Back to the sheets. We keep coming back to Alan hanging them out to dry, needing to keep a weather eye on the mountains, undeterred by the steep climb, the clapping cabbage trees, though he wouldn't speak of it, you knew. How the mountains to the south kept him moored here at the harbour's rim, his mouth clamped around the pegs, something scouring his insides like bleach. We're nearly home when you tell of the last bleached sheet, steeped in sour and sweet, not a thing to keep, used to wrap this southern man, his breastbone, eyes, mouth, feet, valleys, constellations. Peaks.
And that was Eastbourne's Mary McCallan reading her poem Southern Man. Let's complete the 2024 memories of retired librarian Alan Smith talking with Hutt City Libraries Tricia Meehan.
What do you think has been the most important change in libraries? Or do you think there has been a change in terms of what they offer?
Oh, yeah, there has. One continuing disappointment is that there's a strong threat of conservatism in library people, coupled with a strong thread of management bullshit. So libraries seem to be full of people with doing strategic interfaces and new wave of new paradigms and all that sort of stuff. There's been that this conservatism plus this sort of getting carried away with trendy things, which in actual fact, you know, are pretty nebulous. There's a place for libraries, but they're not as sort of psychobabble things and not as just loads of books. There is a good middle path, and I think the Hub thing, like a tighter, offers a clue to that. But much more closer tie-up of the virtual side of the library with the physical side. Because even when I go here, they seem to be run as different things. I ordered a book on Interloan. It was a relatively recent publication, and the message came back, oh, look, we can't get hold of it. You might be able to get it through the internet. So I said, yeah, I don't mind how to get it, you know, just... And that was seen as a sort of novelty. Oh, okay. Whereas I would have thought correct response would have been, oh, here's this guy who wants this book. All right, it's on this website. Send him the website link. And, you know, rather than say, oh, yes. Well, we can't get it. You know what I mean?
That would have been a fuller response, yes.
Yeah. So it's like the APN case thing. As you go through the library, as you walk past, you watch all these people. Everyone at these computers, but it seems you've got to pay for it, is that right? And people pay?
No, it's not anymore.
No, it was at one stage.
It was pay.
It just seemed to me as if it was, I don't know, somehow... What I'm getting at is, as far as my grandchildren are concerned, you did get into all this stuff through the screen, fair enough. And if libraries can become this gateway into this whole world of knowledge sort of thing, it's not a substitute for doing it at home, but it can add layers to it. I think I mentioned this in the article here too. There was I found this in university libraries. About the lower hut, yeah. Since then I've seen the same malaise in certain US university libraries. Huge things built in the 1960s, you know, full of air conditioning plants and all sort of stuff, and these librarians sort of marooned inside it, moaning, saying, oh, we haven't got enough money. But the world had moved on. There are other ways of delivering that library service rather than sitting in these giant buildings. I mean, that sounds a bit garbled.
So you're impressed by the tighter hub, that sort of model with the...
Oh, yes.
Providing the sort of sports facilities and the library.
The fact that there's the books and all that sort of stuff are there, but there's other things going on round about. I'm a bit surprised the 901 is still run separately from the old post office. Is that right?
Yes.
Whereas you think the two would be administratively combined or something.
All the libraries are hubs now. So, I mean, the idea is to be bringing people into the hubs.
Yeah, I know, but you've got to have something to do when you get there.
Yes.
Otherwise you lapse into the management bullshit of going, we're a community interface, you know, there's nothing actually behind it, sort of thing. And I mentioned the Tighter one. I was up Tighter on the weekend. I just stuck my head in and get a cup of coffee at the Nash place, and you can see all these people buzzing around, you know. It's good to see. I don't know if there's if you can do that while retaining the ability for Ian North type people in Tighter nowadays to go in and discover J.W.M. Turner. Wow, this is bloody... Oh, I can actually take it home and look at it, you know. It must be possible for that to happen in the Tighter Library, if it's encouraged and able to happen. We had a very good system in Whangarei, which my predecessor had put in place, that there was no membership thing. Every time you borrow books, you just write out your name and address. And the number of the book. So at school visits, you know, people didn't have to produce their library card, just put down there. Now, sure, there's probably some got lost and all that sort of stuff. But I used to quite enjoy, and it sounds boasting, but it's not intended as that. At Whangarei, I worked a couple of evenings a week. The library's open till, say, 8:30 night, you know. Now, I'd go through the list of stuff that were overdue and go off in the car and pick out crummy suburbs and knock on the door and say, oh, look, a few library books out, you know. And, I'll take them back if you like, you know, save your trip. So, oh, yeah. And all these the books that come out from underneath. You know, you could hear the kids getting yelled at by their mother afterwards sometimes, but other times they say, oh, Jesus, you know, weren't quite sure how it worked. Or, that's right, I said, that's right. Come again, you know. That sort of opened my eyes a bit to, you know, how people were living and sort of crowded. Whereas nowadays I suspect they had their library card blocked and...
Well, there are no phones now.
But even so.
Yeah, even so, you're right. You can actually...
The mere fact you had to get a card to start off with, didn't
you? Yes, that's right.
And if you've got a computer system, you've got to have a card.
And you have to have some ID.
ID and all that sort of
stuff. But this stuff, everyone sort of is quite helpful for them.
They'll
send a letter to the address so you can bring it in, saying, this is my address.
I mean, quite possibly the Whangarei system was open for abuse, and it probably... And I'm sure it wouldn't still exist, but it was a good system that worked there in those segments, especially in the time of school visits. Look, if you want that book, take it home. Yes. Just drop it back next week. And it worked.
So do you feel like you retired at the right, you know, like you've been retired for 20 years?
Yeah, my father had died when he was just about 3 months before turning 60, and he'd been looking forward to retire. He was successful in his job, and he wasn't desperate to leave or anything like that. But, so I made myself a little promise many years ago, I'm going to retire before I'm 60, you know, just to beat the odds sort of thing. And so I was able to do that, because... I was able to finish up at Vic on a bit of a high. There were three big projects. They were listed there, I think, and you sort of get those all knocked off, left. And since then, you know, life's been pretty good. I've become a grandparent, and your children get married, and they... No, it's nice.
So your retirement, you do... it's a bit of a cliché question. Do you do a lot of reading?
Probably... There's an important aspect to that, and that relates to the library here, is inevitably when you're working at Vic or National Library, you take stuff home at night, you know, files or reports and things you catch up on. Whereas after I retired, I didn't have to borrow about all that stuff. So I made a point, not a bucket thing, but just made a point of reading up the history of the 1940s and 50s. In other words, the time immediately before my birth and the time of my childhood, when I was a boy growing up and riding a bike around and leading a pretty happy life, you know, carefree, what actually was going on. In actual fact, the world was a hell of a mess, you know, all sorts of weird things going on. So I've enjoyed doing that, which is a combination of reading and television and visits and all that sort of thing. One of the ways that I have had more time for reading is of fiction, because fiction is often the best way of explaining the world. It's a very, very powerful thing. And you can read all this factual stuff, you know, but getting the habit of immersed in novels, I've found more and more enjoyable as time has gone on this last couple of decades. Whereas beforehand I didn't read fiction all that much because you're doing other things. There's some terrific stuff around, I must say, and the Lower Hutt Library's always had a good range of stuff. And that probably, there seem to be more books being published now than ever there were before, but presumably that will change over time. But as long as the library keeps open to new technologies, but keeps that node to the wider world of knowledge type thing going, keeps thinking of the north type of, you know, light bulb moment. Another guy, McDiarmid, you know, McDiarmid, the scientist.
Ah, yes.
1930s and 40s. very much a pioneer in the nuclear sciences mm-hmm. sort of area. Mm-hmm. And he has described in his autobiography of coming to the Lower Hutt Library as a boy in the 1930s or 40s and finding a book about radio valves and opening it and
yes.
Wow. Right. You know, that light bulb, yeah, and that was Alan McDonald.
And just to go back to the local, the Hutt Library and setting up the local studies collection,
yeah, yeah.
Were there any particular challenges about doing that? Did it come to mind, or was it just something that was quite straightforward?
Yeah, I think it was quite straightforward. There was stuff there. There were files of the Hutt News and there were books and that, but it was all a bit hit and miss. Mm. So it was a notion of making a focus of it. It was well before website sort of time, but you could, you know, just making a point of trying to get your hand on supermarket flyers and ephemera sort of stuff. It was a case, I think, just gather the stuff and secure it and worry about how to organise it later on. And the family history research thing was well established at that stage, but there was no particular problem about it. It was more that general expectation that I mentioned earlier was that the public library was a way, it was, you know, 150 years ago they were set up so that people could read books from the old country and so forth, because there's no other way of doing it. But when I was a kid in the 1950s, the library was a way of getting out of Lower Hutt. So the local studies thing is part of that business of, there's plenty of other ways of getting out of Lower Hutt these days. How do you find out about what actually makes the place tick?
Yes.
Which reflects on you as an individual, you know, how did I get here?
Anything else you'd like to add?
What, one of 100,000 people who lives in the town and it's people coming and going all the time. There's all sorts of intangible things about towns and places, and people relate to those places, but they also relate to the people around them and their families and their friends and this sort of thing. You could say I was fortunate in living on the right side of the tracks and in a loving family with a faith-based sort of context, and there was no particular traumas or anything like that. But on the other hand, you could say, well, there's one person's cosy environment might be another person's stifling environment, or one person's trauma might be another person's, gee, this is exciting.
Yeah.
Individuals are very diverse, and I suspect that I know there's a role for this public library thing as the collector of local memory, node to the wider world of knowledge, and access to things like fiction and books for children, in particular picture books and that sort of stuff. I'm not sure that the non-fiction sort of side of things will, in some ways, that probably will decline over time when other people get other ways of getting there.
Well, thank you very much, Alan.
Good. Right. Okay. Well, look, I hope that sort of met expectations.
That's great. Thank you.
I'm Jim McDonald, and you're in the Hutt Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was Lower Hutt's Alan Smith sharing his memories with Hutt City Library's Tricia Meehan in 2024. Thank you to the library for sharing that interview on the Recollect platform. Time for some piano music from Lower Hutt's William Berry. Here he is playing Liszt's Third Paganini, Etude la Campanella. It's recorded at the Hutt Valley High School annual acoustic concert in 2019, recorded at St. Mark's Church, Woburn Road, Lower Hutt. Thank you. that was former Hatfield High School student William Berry playing in 2019 at St. Mark's Church, Lower Hutt. And that was Liszt's third Paganini Etude La Campanella. The next is our feature story of the week. Do you know a Hutt teenager who could do with a confidence-boosting session? Then my next guest's workshop in Petone could be the very thing you're looking for.
My name is Brendan Green, and the title of the workshop is Confidence in Public Speaking. I'm really excited about this opportunity to do this public speaking workshop, especially in Petone. So my story is that I've actually just moved down from Auckland to Wellington at the end of last year, and I've had a long relationship with Jerome Chandrahausen, who runs the Humorous Arts Trust. And he was excited for me to come down, or at least he tells me that to my face. And he has been setting up these workshops for me. It's how it basically came about. He was the one that applied and put me forward for it. The amazing people at the Hutt City Council Creative Communities Scheme have backed it. And so now we get to put it on for the teens of Petone.
So what's the workshop goal?
Well, the workshop goal is, very simply, just to make whoever turns up feel good about themselves and in their abilities to speak publicly. I mean, it's such a key little skill to have. You're always going to be talking to people in social groups or at parties or job interviews or in front of a class doing speeches. Everybody has to talk. It's a very common anxiety or a common fear to think maybe, oh, am I not good enough for this, or I don't know how to do it, I'm not interesting, I can't do that. But really, it is a little perspective shift, and so that's what the goal is, just to shift those perspectives for anyone who thinks that they might not be good enough or might be a little bit worried about doing any kind of speaking in front of people. So yeah, that's the goal, is to shift some perspectives and make people realize that they are actually incredibly unique and interesting, and people are interested in what they have to say.
So how are you going to achieve those goals in the workshop? How are you going to run the session?
Oh, it's going to be a very strict boot camp, a lot of harsh words, and no, it's not at all.
That's one way of doing it, I suppose.
But... I mean, I'm sure it's one way to do it. That's definitely not the way that I do it. I run very collaborative workshops. I make sure people feel good and safe and welcome, and we don't put pressure on people to participate, but obviously participation does kind of like engender a bit more confidence. And by the end of these workshops, everybody does generally seem to be participating and feeling a lot more confident in themselves. So that's how we do things with these workshops. It's a nice fun and funny way to kind of crack the seal on public speaking.
So what sort of stuff will people have the option to do during it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there will be there's going to be a lot of practical techniques. I think a lot of people like the, like, yeah, but what can I actually do physically? Or like, what can I do? Like, what are the real practical things I can add to my vocabulary or my voice or my stance to make myself appear more confident, which is totally legitimate. I mean, some people might be like, no, that's a shortcut, that's cheating. No, it's not at all. So I'll be teaching a lot of just really practical techniques of how to change your appearance while speaking. So that'll be great. But mostly it will also be discovering like ways to look at the way that you see the world. So I'll be asking questions and probing about like people's inside worlds and realizing that their outlook on life is actually very unique and interesting. And so then, therefore, they can feel confident that people will either find it very relatable or educational and entertaining. There will definitely be like little practical tips and tricks. So everybody will walk away with something.
What age group are you targeting?
So this one is for ages 14 to 18. So we'll be kind of like, yeah, tailored there. And we've got 20 spaces. So people do need to book ahead. Otherwise, it might fill up. And they can do that on Eventfinder. You can find links for that online. But yes, for 14 to 18-year-olds will be this confidence in public speaking workshop.
Why that demographic? Why that teenage group?
Well, I mean, this is the age group that you are almost quite often forced to do some public speaking, especially at school or when attending job interviews, or there's many scenarios where you do have to kind of become part of society and start doing these public speaking things. And that can be very intimidating and very anxiety inducing, especially if you haven't had that kind of upbringing or that kind of that lifestyle where you can fall into that naturally, or what people think is naturally. It's actually not. People learn how to do it. And so this is a really, really important pivotal time. And I cast my mind back. I remember when I was in that age bracket, I was a very scared and anxious teenager. And I didn't back myself. I didn't realize how to do those things. I wanted to. I saw that and I went, oh, I'd love to be able to do that. And I would get absolutely terrified before having to do a speech for English class. And I look back now, I'm like, oh yeah, no, I had all the tools. I just didn't realize that I did. And I could have saved myself a lot of anguish and anxiety about it. But yeah, I think it's a really important time in life to develop some of these skills.
How does the workshop compare to your tutoring high schoolers for the Class Comedians program that you've done?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was really fun doing the Class Comedians, because that was specifically about stand-up comedy, which is an entire art form on its own. It's a very specific art form and craft. So that was very much, hey, here's how jokes work, and getting these teens ready to perform a set of stand-up comedy, which is very different to a speech or just being able to speak in general in public. So that's the main difference is, like, they will be able to, this one will definitely have humorous aspects and how to craft a joke and how to tell a joke and land a joke, but that's not the main focus. So the Class Comedians was 100% stand-up comedy, which was fantastic. This one is more general for public speaking.
Right, right. Well, what's been your path into comedy then? When did it all start for you?
Yeah, so I've been doing comedy for a long time, about 20 years ago I started. And like a lot of things, I kind of just found myself falling into it. It was never a dream. It was never the goal to get into it. I never thought that I could do it. So my start actually was my friend started doing stand-up comedy, Dave Wiggins, when he was he visited here from America. And I made friends with him, and he started doing stand-up comedy because that was his dream and that was his goal. And I was just a tag along, and we actually started doing musical comedy. I was learning guitar, and I would write some silly songs. And then he was like, "Oh, get up on stage! Let's do a comedy duo." And so we did a comedy duo together for a few years, and that was really fun. I always let him be the star, let him be the main person who did all the talking, and I was just like happy to be there. And then eventually I started getting the bug for it, and I started doing some solo comedy, which is lovely. And yeah, I found out that I was funnier than him the whole time. And, and he loves when I tell the story. So yes, and then I started falling into that, and then I've just kept doing it. That's one of the key things that I kind of found out, is you just keep turning up, and eventually slow and steady will win the race.
So when did you decide to get serious with your comedy, went to, you know, to go professional?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm still waiting for that time. It's going to be amazing when it actually happens. I started, it's quite a long thing to do. If to do stand-up comedy, to do comedy, you really have to be passionate about it, because it's not very rewarding, A, financially or socially, because you're out long hours, you're hanging out with just the same people. It's very lovely in that regard. But you do have to continue on with a full-time job or other means to survive. So the barrier to entry is quite high in that regard. So after a few years, I was actually working at Universal Music as a writer for them and interviewing and selling Selena Gomez CDs and everything like that. And they were really supportive of me. So they allowed me to go part-time and then focus a bit more on the comedy. And then after a few years of that, I went, oh, I've got enough work here, enough gigs, enough jobs, enough writing work that I could go full-time. And yeah, 10, 12 years later, that's still working.
So what's the range of comedy activities that you do?
Oh, that's really fun. There's a handful of full-time stand-up comedians in New Zealand, and only a few of them actually do stand-up comedy as their main income. Everybody else does comedy-adjacent work. So I love getting up on stage. I love doing the performance and the writing. I'm also very lucky that I have a big passion for writing for other people. So my, as well as doing the stand-up comedy, I write a lot of TV, which is really fun. I've been lucky enough to work on like 7 Days. I was a head writer for Have You Been Paying Attention, working with Hayley Sproul. I loved writing in her voice. I really like finding other performers and writing in their voice, writing jokes for them. And I probably shouldn't say that out loud, because everybody should say that they write and perform their own jokes. But spoiler alert, not everything is written by the people saying it on TV.
Mm-hmm. What about the teaching side? How did the teaching piece start?
Yes, well, the teaching was really fun. They, I started with the New Zealand Comedy Festival when they were doing the Class Comedians program. And I jumped in as that had been running for a good kind of 5-6 years before I jumped in. There were some amazing people who were the Ben Hurley was one of the tutors on that one in its early days. Jan Marie, absolutely wonderful comedians. And then as part of their development of younger comedians, including myself, they saw that I had a good way with younger people, and had a very growth open mindset and was open to teaching. So they tapped me to jump in as one of the tutors, and then I really took to it. I loved seeing the development of other people, seeing from day one to day 20, just the development and the change and the confidence that had grown. So I was kind of like bought in on that one. And since then, we did Class Comedians for a long time. I also teach in New Zealand Comedy School, which was founded by Neil Thornton, which is really, really fun. And I've been doing some other development work for the New Zealand Comedy Festival for kind of more developed comedians in their second or third years of festivals. So I don't know. I really like watching other people do well. I don't know what that says about me, but there you go. That's why I like it.
Do you get out much and see other comedians performing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. At the start, it's really important if you want to get into stand-up to go see some other comedians, go see as much live shows as possible, because you're still developing your voice, right? So you want to see everything. You want to see what you do like, see what you don't like, and then kind of find where you want to be. The more you do it, the less shows you go out to, because, you know, it's a long drive and you've seen all the jokes before. But I love when I'm on a lineup, especially with a new comedian that I haven't seen before, so I can see some fresh new material. And it's been great moving down to Wellington and just seeing all of these acts that I've heard about that I haven't seen in person. So, yeah, it's been really fun watching and performing with all these new people, which is exciting.
Your own style of performance and stand-up, how did you describe that?
Ooh, my style is I tell personal stories that are very relatable, and the emotion that I kind of live in seems to be shame, a lot of shame-based comedy, because I find that to be really relatable. Either the audience goes, oh, yay, I also feel that, or they feel, oh, yay, I'm not that. So either way, they feel seen or happy that they don't do the things that I've done. And so, yes, I like making people feel good about themselves and the world. So, yes, I like building connections with that. I like building a warmth and a bit of a community with the audience and making people feel, I feel like a little bit woo-woo here, but I'm like, I like making people feel good about the world and about themselves in it. And it's like, which seems like quite highfalutin. I also just tell dumb jokes because that's what comedy is. But yeah, I do aim to create a bit of warmth and connection with everybody.
Has your style changed over those last 20 years, or you've always been into shame? so to speak.
Now we're getting into therapy. it has definitely changed a little bit. When you start out in stand-up, you're always... there's this thing I like to say where you're either a writer who has to learn how to perform or a performer who has to learn how to write. I was definitely a writer, so I was writing all these jokes and then getting up on stage all nervous and not delivering them very well until I was like, why aren't people laughing at this? It's not because of the words, it's because of my delivery. And so I had to work on becoming a lot more confident on stage, which again gives me a nice a bit of expertise, I guess, for this confidence in public speaking. I've been through that process of, like, I was absolutely terrified on stage until I figured out how not to be, and now I can pass on these tips and tricks, which is quite good. And yeah, I dabbled in musical comedy, I've dabbled in storytelling, the art form, I've dabbled in one-liners, but I found the most consistent success with my kind of longer form stories and connecting live with some audience interaction and just building a community with the audience.
So attendance at the workshop, where could that possibly lead to for participants?
Ooh, I mean, there's an election coming up, isn't there? So maybe a late entry into that. Let's really do some big, large-scale change. Honestly, like, public speaking just appears every single place in the world, right? It is talking to your flatmates. It's talking to somebody at Pack and Save Kilburnie. It is talking to a job interview. It is in class doing a speech. It could be in front of school assembly in front of 2,000 people. So it literally will, like, the tentacles of public speaking skills reach out all throughout life. And if somebody from this class does go on to becoming this rich and successful, amazing public speaker / comedian, then I will be riding their coattails because I can claim that I was part of that. And I think there's some fine print where I do get 20% commission for any future sales of public speaking work. Yeah.
Fair enough. So the logistics, it's at Petone Library, the 1st of March, 2 to 3:30. As you said, you need to enroll through Event Finder. Is there a cost to attend?
No, it's absolutely not. It's being covered by the Hutt City Council Creative Community Scheme, which was absolutely fantastic. They actually funded this workshop and one of the shows at the Abandoned Tap Room, which is on Friday the 20th, which is going to be if you want to see a bit of fantastic Kiwi comedy, that's got Jeremy Corbett, Justine Smith, my favourite comedian, don't tell the other ones, Sully O'Sullivan, and then a couple of locals that I've just met. I want to shout out Katie Borrows. She, I've gigged with her a couple of times down here. She's just new into it. Absolutely fantastic. Like, she's one of my favourite locals at the moment. So yeah, there's a lot going on.
And the Abandoned Tap Room is in Petone, as is obviously the Petone Library. Why was Petone picked as a place to run the workshop from?
I believe that's where Jerome pitched. He's the admin man. I just do what I'm told, John. He went, Petone, we're doing Petone. And I went, that sounds like the greatest place on earth. Let's do it. And is it? Let's find out.
Have you performed in the Hutt before?
No, I haven't. It's going to be my first time, I believe. It's going to be very fun. A couple of weekends ago, I went up to your main suburb, though. That was very fun. I went up to Brewtown, and I checked out there, which was very nice. One day, that's the dream. I've seen shows at the Abandoned Tap Room. It's such a great venue, and I'm keen to jump up on the stage there.
So what else is coming up for you?
Yeah, so I've got we've got a couple of these workshops, actually. We've got one just booked for Featherston as well, which is exciting. We've got I'm teaming up with my friend Dave Wiggins again. He's coming down, and we're actually doing a clean comedy show at the Fringe Bar in Wellington Central, which is just where I do all my jokes without swearing. It's very good. And so that'll be a really fun one to reconnect with Dave. I haven't gigged with him in many years. So that's in March, I believe. The New Zealand Comedy Festival is coming up. It's phenomenal. I'll be partaking in some shows that. I'll also be judging a couple of awards, I believe. There's a lot going on in the world of comedy, especially down here in Wellington. I'm excited.
Yeah, certainly at the moment it's very, very active. So it is. Finally, Brendan, your message to Hutt Zone radio listeners on trying out for the 1st of March in Petone, what message would you have for them?
Oh, absolutely. So my message would be, if you've ever thought about public speaking, then come along and do it. Otherwise, it might sit around as a little bit of a regret, a little bit of a eating away at you. I can tell you right now, it's a very low stakes, very no pressure. It will not be traumatizing. And if you've ever thought, oh, I'd like to be better at a bit of public speaking, then this is the workshop for you. I promise that I can make you feel a bit better about yourself and give you some really practical skills on how to enhance your public speaking. And plus, it's an hour and a half on a Sunday. What else are you going to be doing? Sitting at home reading? Absolutely not. Come along, do some talking. It'll be great.
Indeed, it will be great. I'm John McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. And that was Brendan Green talking about his confidence and public speaking workshop Sunday, the 1st of March at Petone Library. A free workshop brought by the Hutt City Council's Creative Fund and Humorous Trust. But you do need to register, and you can do that on Eventfinder. Sadly, that's all we have time for in this week's show. Thank you to all my guests tonight, and as ever, a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. You can listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hutt Zone pages of accessradio.org.nz. If you have a good idea of a local Hutt story, poem, or piece of music, then please let us know either on Facebook, John McDonald NZ, or email us. And our email is thehutzone@outlook.co.nz. Let's go out with music from Moira-based Vox Ethno. Here they are performing La Stavika. Until next Thursday, keep safe. Mate wa en noho oru mai ra. Stay well.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.